Continuing now through May 19th, Davenport's Figge Museum is showcasing a gorgeous visiting exhibition called Lewis Comfort Tiffany Treasures from the Driehaus Collection. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum for the Iowa Art Showcase, and in to tell us about this amazing Tiffany display is the Figge's Director of Collections and Exhibitions, Andrew Wallace. And thank you so much for coming in today, Andrew.
My pleasure.
You just had your fantastic French Moderns exhibit, and now you have this wonderful exhibit of works from the Driehaus Museum in Chicago. So tell us a little bit about Lewis Comfort Tiffany and why his glass is so spectacular and unusual.
Well, Lewis Comfort Tiffany is the son of Charles Tiffany, and Charles Tiffany made his fortune with what became Tiffany and Company, better known as the jewelry store with the little blue gift boxes based in New York. But it is his father's success that allowed Lewis Comfort Tiffany first to study art and travel the world and develop his skills as an artist and as a designer. And it is indeed his father's success that helped Lewis take care of his own business, LC Tiffany and Company, over the years, because much of what they produced was quite expensive and it was for a particular clientele. And so there were times when they were producing things that were perhaps a little bit beyond their financial capacity. And so he filled in the blanks, so to speak, with money he earned as one of the directors of Tiffany and Company.
And he didn't really start out in stained glass. He actually started out as a painter.
He did start out as a painter. He was very much a person, a man of his times. So he studied with a number of important people. George Innes was an influence on Tiffany, but like his colleague artists in the 1860s, as a young man, he traveled to Europe. He met well-established French artists and from them learned a lot about art and design, and in particular, the influence of the Orient. And by Orient, I mean the Near East, so Egypt, North Africa, Morocco, and Turkey. So that, to me, is an interesting aspect of his work. The influence of Persian carpets to Moroccan mosaics finds its way into the work of Lewis Comfort Tiffany and his artisans.
So how did he get into glass? How did he transfer from painting to glass?
Well, early on, as I understand it, he became interested in doing interior design and decoration, and it was not uncommon, for instance, for architects of the period to design all aspects of a client's interior. Another example would be Stanford White, who was not trained as an architect, but became an important architect of his time with Kim Mead and White, and also would do interior designs for his clients. And for instance, Stanford White worked on the home that Lewis's father built in New York City, which was a grand Richardsonian Romanesque design that then Lewis, young Lewis, outfitted or designed the interiors for with the help of Stanford White. So this period, the Gilded Age, we should call it. There was a great deal of cross-pollination between architects and designers and painters. One of Tiffany's competitors, John Lafarge, was also a colleague and friend. And so you have this group of highly talented individuals who are well-traveled and well-schooled, all sort of competing on the one hand and sharing information about design and aesthetics.
Well, at one point, he even went out and built his own glass furnace.
That's true. So what I'm not an expert on is the number of companies or divisions that LC Tiffany had. There are quite a few, and they changed names over time. And why that is, I'm not sure. But the purpose of developing your own glass furnace was to be able to control the process of making glass and in Lewis's case, making glass that was well suited to the types of designs that he wanted to create and the decorations that he wanted to employ in his interiors.
And he even patented his own kind of glass.
Yes, he did. There's some debate about whether John Lafarge originated the opalescent glass process or Tiffany. They both filed patents and were successful in getting patents for their opalescent glass designs. Tiffany trademarked his opalescent glass as Favrille, and it's a major component in his windows and mosaics and lamps. And that's the thing I think that we most recognize about Tiffany and his innovations in glass in particular.
So tell us about this amazing treasures from the Driehaus collection that has come to the Figge.
Well, the collection on view at the Figge now is about 60-some-odd works from the Driehaus collection. Driehaus himself has collected over 1,500 objects, probably more by now, from Tiffany and his various workshops. What this exhibition does is it encapsulates sort of all the aspects of Tiffany and his team of artisans and their design capabilities and capacity. And so it's a nice one-stop shop, if you will, for anyone who's interested in Tiffany or just curious about it. Certainly Davenport and the Figge Art Museum is a lot closer to Central Iowa than Chicago is. So if you don't think you're going to make it to Chicago to see the Driehaus Museum in person, perhaps a shorter trip to Davenport would be more in line with your traveling abilities. So I recommend it highly. It's a lovely collection of objects. It explains what Tiffany was capable of producing, Tiffany and his artisans. There are a number of examples of works and designs by women who were an important part of L.C. Tiffany at the turn of the century. And so that's, I think, also important because it's a turning point when women are engaged more, and it's just shy by 20 years of the women's right to vote. So I think it's fascinating, and there's a lot there for anyone who's interested in decorative arts and materials like this.
Well, you were the lucky curator that got to set this whole exhibit up. And when you have glass, you have to have the correct lighting. How did that go?
Well, the beauty of this exhibition, which was organized in conjunction with the Driehaus Museum and an organization called International Arts and Artists, which is based in Washington, D.C., is that they, in order to display and to protect the windows that are included in this exhibition, and there are seven of those, that special displays had to be made and travel with the exhibition to maintain the integrity of the presentation and the well-being of the windows. So that greatly aided our ability to put on a nice display. These pieces of display material that hold the windows are lighted so you can get a good sense of the breadth and the depth and the amazing creation that Tiffany and his artisans made in making these windows, because they are quite wonderful. And so the exhibition is designed around the windows in your ability to appreciate the stained glass in its fullest.
Tell us about some of the items that, in addition to the windows, are part of this collection.
So there are vases, candlesticks. There are candlesticks that are glass. There are candlesticks that are glass and bronze. There are about 16 lamps, including a floor-standing lamp with a variety of shades and a variety of bronze bases, plus objets d'art, the things you would find on a person's desk or vanity, so inkwells and humidor and cigar holders and that sort of thing. So you get the full range of objects that L.C. Tiffany and company was able to produce, and also a sense of all the different influences essentially from all over the world that made their way into the designs that you see in the exhibit. So it's really quite rich and fascinating. So you have some very small glass objects, which are sort of indicative of trends in the arts and crafts movement, to larger vases that are more in line with what you would see in Art Nouveau and the aesthetic movement. So you see all that, and it's all sort of neatly gathered together in this one exhibition.
So does he get involved with the metal work? I'm thinking about some of these lamps that have exotic bases on them and things like that.
So like any master of a large multifaceted company, at first Tiffany was fully hands-on as he worked to develop designs. But as client demands grew, he grew his company to take on artisans to help him satisfy his clients' needs and to produce the kinds of objects that they were demanding and in the quantities that he needed to produce them in order to be successful at it. So as that evolved, his role went from hands-on to an oversight role, but it is understood that all along, Tiffany would have final say on designs, might even make notations or alterations to drawings that were produced by the artisans working under him. And this is true of the lamps. If a design was just too ornate and perhaps seemingly too costly to produce, he would intervene and either the design would be changed or the idea would be nixed, because there was a certain level where things just were not going to sell. So even for the well-heeled and members of the Gilded Age families, there were just some things that they could not do, which was a frustration, I know, for the lamp makers, because there was a desire to produce even more wonderful and elaborate designs in the lamps, but the lamps were doing really well for Tiffany. And so, you know, that you needed to keep the costs in control.
I was surprised to find out that there are actually some Tiffany pieces in Iowa. And in fact, there's a really interesting story about Tiffany and Davenport. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, in 1910, Tiffany produced a pamphlet illustrating over 1,100 examples of windows across the country and elsewhere in the world and where they were located. And in this pamphlet, it lists Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Peoria, Illinois, as places where Tiffany windows for ecclesiastical commissions were located, and also for memorials. And memorials like mausoleums, Tiffany produced, would produce windows and designs for maybe a stone mausoleum structure or even headstones that might be found in a cemetery. And as you might imagine, if you have these well-heeled clients who are interested in the aesthetic that's being produced by Tiffany, they're naturally going to go to the only person they know, Elsie Tiffany, to commission, say, headstones or monuments for loved ones because they wanted to respect them and honor them. In the Chippinook Cemetery in Rock Island, the Denkman family produced a mausoleum for FCA Denkman, who was one of the two men who was responsible ultimately for the Weyerhaeuser Lumber Company. Denkman died in 1905, and a mausoleum was built based on a design produced by Elsie Tiffany and Company, or Tiffany Studios. And this mausoleum included a window. And in 1976, the window was stolen from that mausoleum, as well as another stained glass window from another mausoleum at the Chippinook Cemetery on Rock Island, and disappeared. The superintendent of that cemetery, Joseph Vogel, tried to pursue or track down and, of course, reported the theft to law enforcement at the time. He retired the year after, but his son, Greg, followed up and continued to persevere over what must have been more than 20 years, sending letters to institutions and perhaps organizations that would have an interest in Tiffany windows or decorative objects to see if they had heard anything or come across anything or perhaps even had acquired anything into their own collections that might resemble the window, as it's known, the River of Life window, in their collections. And it just so happens in the 1990s, the Charles Hosmer Morse Museum in Florida was contacted by a couple that was interested, I believe, in selling a window that they had to them. And the Morse Museum then reached out to Greg Vogel and said, "We have people who have a window that matches the description of the window that was stolen from your mausoleum." enter the FBI, and so there was a great deal of effort to recover the window. And this couple had purchased the window from somebody else, and so after that, the trail is cold. But they were completely innocent of it. They had just essentially purchased something that had been stolen unbeknownst to them. One of the interesting things that I've come across was that early on after the theft of the window in 1976 or 1977, and this is in one of the newspaper accounts, somebody had remembered a phone call where somebody was asking about the Donkman window. And this pronunciation, obviously, was close to Denkman. And it turns out that there is a typo in the Tiffany brochure that was published in 1910 of all these windows across the country and elsewhere, which explains why the person who might have been seeking out windows to steal mispronounced the name of the Donkman window. So in a way, the Tiffany brochure published in 1910 was sort of an advertisement for potential thieves who are interested in finding windows, particularly in cemeteries that might not be as well guarded, say, for instance, as a public or more public building. So they could use that as a way of identifying potential targets. So that's sort of an unfortunate aspect of that. But it's interesting. So the window was recovered and returned to the Denkman family. The window had been broken at some point during its journey, being removed from the mausoleum and then to the couple that lived in New York from whom it was recovered. And then it was repaired, and this was the late 1990s, by a Tiffany window expert. And then it came to the Davenport Museum of Art, where it was placed on view for a couple of years. And then after that, a new display was made for it at the Figge. And so it was on display when the Figge opened in 2005.
So are you having it as part of this exhibit you have right now?
Well, it's not a part of the exhibit. It would be too difficult in its current form and installation to move from where it is on the second floor to the third floor where the Tiffany Treasures exhibition is. But it is a wonderful example. There are seven windows in the Tiffany exhibition. And I have to say that this particular window, the Denkman window, has all the important aspects of Tiffany window making incorporated into it. So it is certainly a worthy side trip if you were to come to the Figge to go down and see the Denkman window on the museum's second floor.
Now, you are also going to be having a special guest speaker come. Tell us about that.
Well, Arlie Sulka, who's an expert on Tiffany, works for a firm called Lillian Nassau, which is a decorative arts gallery based in New York City and has been around forever. She is often seen on Antiques Roadshow discussing Tiffany objects and other decorative objects because she's an expert in that field. She will be at the Figge to talk about the exhibition generally and Lewis Comfort Tiffany and his studio specifically.
And that's going to be on March 28th, Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And there's going to be a happy hour starting at 4 p.m. before that.
That's correct. That's correct. Yes.
A wonderful opportunity to get to meet her and then, of course, find out all these amazing things about Tiffany. And next week here on the Iowa Art Showcase, we are going to be exploring another Tiffany exhibit. It's one of Iowa's best kept secrets, so I'm hoping our listeners will tune in. So, Andrew, how can folks get more info about this special exhibit running through May 19th?
Well, they should certainly visit the Figge's website at www.figgeartmuseum.org. Learn all about it, and I encourage anybody who's even remotely interested to come see the exhibition before the exhibition is over. You walk into the space, and you are totally enveloped and surrounded by Tiffany works, and so you get a taste of his sort of philosophy about interior design, and, you know, it's a total work of art, to borrow a phrase, to be surrounded by these luxurious materials and objects, and it's quite nice.
Well, that's one thing about seeing an exhibition. When you see all these works all together, you really get a better idea of the artist and the scope of what they created.
That's true. And you certainly will get that feeling when you visit the Treasures exhibition because it is rather delightful.
So, Andrew, is there anything you'd like to add that you really want people to know about this Tiffany exhibit?
There's a few examples of designs by a woman named Clara Driscoll in the exhibition. And Clara Driscoll, in addition to being the head of the Tiffany Girls, which is a group of women who specialize in designing and fabricating the lampshades for Tiffany lamps, she was a designer in her own right. And one important example that's on display in this collection is the Dragonfly lampshade, which I think is my absolute favorite of Tiffany's lampshades. And its existence is owed to this brilliant and talented woman who came up with this design at the turn of the century. So it's really a wonderful treat, I think.
To hear Andrew Wallace's entire interview, please go to our website at iowapublicradio.org, and especially to hear about that Tiffany heist in Davenport. And so what are the hours of the museum? And also there's a little restaurant for lunch.
There's a Figgy Cafe is open Tuesday through Friday. The museum is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to 9 p.m. on Thursdays, 5 p.m. on Fridays, 10 to 5 on Saturdays, and then 12 to 5 on Sundays.
And I believe on Thursday during certain hours in the evening, it's free for people to get in?
That's true. After 5 p.m. on Thursdays, the museum is free, so I encourage you to come. And we have programming that happens, everything from artist talks to discussions of particular artwork to people like Arlie Sulka coming to the museum to give a scholarly talk on whatever it is we might be presenting. So I encourage people to come then.
Thanks for today's interview goes to IPR's Jim Davies, Phil Moss, and Alexis Hahn, and a big thank you to the Figgy's Director of Collections and Exhibitions, Andrew Wallace, for filling us in on this gorgeous Tiffany exhibit at the Figgy. And thank you so much, Andrew.
You're welcome.